Approximately two-thirds of those comprising the decision-making body are now in favor of a public disclosure of some type on this matter. These are, in general, the younger members who have less complicity in past excesses. The remaining members are hardliners opposed to or ambivalent regarding a near-term disclosure. Unfortunately, they remain in control. Actual policy and decision-making seems to rest predominantly, at this time, in the private, civilian sector, as opposed to USAP-related military and intelligence officials, though some information indicates that there is significant relative autonomy in certain areas of operations. It is our current assessment that a rising degree of debate exists regarding certain covert operations and the advisability of a disclosure. White House officials, military and congressional leaders, members of the United Nations, and other world leaders are not routinely briefed on this matter. When and if inquiries are made, they are told nothing about the operations, nor is the existence of any operation confirmed to them. In general, the nature of this covert entity ensures that such leaders do not even know to whom such inquiries should be addressed. International cooperation exists to a wide extent, though some witnesses state that certain countries, particularly China, have aggressively pursued somewhat independent agendas. Major bases of operations, apart from widely diversified private sites, include Edwards Air Force Base in California, Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada, particularly S-4 and adjacent facilities, Los Alamos in New Mexico, Fort Huachuca in Arizona, Army Intelligence Headquarters, the Redstone Arsenal in Alabama, and a relatively new, expanding underground facility, accessible only by air, in a remote area of Utah, among others. Additional facilities and operation centers exist in a number of other countries, including the United Kingdom, Australia, and Russia. Numerous agencies have deep cover units involved with these operations, including the National Reconnaissance Office, NRO, the National Security Agency, NSA, the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, AFOSI, Naval Intelligence, Army Intelligence, Air Force Intelligence, the FBI, and a group known as Magic Control. The majority of scientific, technical and advanced technology operations are centered in the civilian industrial and research firms. Significant and lethal security is provided by private contractors. In 1994, Senator Barry Goldwater told me that the secrecy surrounding the ET subject was a damn mistake then and a damn mistake now. I am inclined to agree with the senator here, but the drive for secrecy was not and is not altogether rooted in stupidity. Rather, I see it rooted in fear and a lack of trust. While I generally dislike psychobabble, I believe the psychology of all of this is important. It is my belief that secrecy, especially extreme secrecy of this degree, is always a symptom of illness. If you have secrets in your family, it is a sickness born out of fear, insecurity and distrust. This, I feel, can be extended to communities, companies, and societies. Ultimately, the drive for secrecy is a symptom of a deeper malaise derived from a fundamental lack of trust, and an abundance of fear and insecurity. In the case of UFOs and ETs, the early days of the 1940s and 1950s were a time of fear and uncertainty. The Soviet Union was expanding its empire and arming itself to the teeth with bigger and deadlier nuclear weapons. They had launched Sputnik and were beating us in the race into space. Now along come extraterrestrial spacecraft, which are retrieved along with deceased, and one living, life form. Panic. Fear. Confusion. Countless unanswered questions arise, all tinged with fear. Why are they here? How will the public react? How can we secure their technology and keep it from our mortal enemies? How can we tell the people that the most powerful air force in the world cannot control its airspace? What will happen to religious belief? To the economic order? To political stability? To the keepers of current technology? It is my opinion that the early days of secrecy were predictable, even understandable, and possibly even justifiable. But as the decades roll by, and especially with the end of the Cold War, fear alone does not fully explain the secrecy. After all, 2017 is not 1947. We have been to space, landed on the moon, detected planets around other star systems, found the building blocks of life in far away space, and about half the population believes UFOs are real. Plus, the Soviet Empire has collapsed. I believe three significant factors are now in play: greed and control, and the inertia of decades of secrecy. Greed and control are easily understood. The bureaucratic inertia of large secret operations is yet another matter. After decades of operations, lies, public deceptions and worse, how does such a group unravel all the webs it has weaved? There is a certain addictive allure to secret power for some types of people. They are charged by having and knowing secrets. And there is the specter of a sort of cosmic Watergate, with all manner of people calling for this head or that. It becomes easy to maintain the status quo, something all bureaucracies are adept at doing. And even now there is fear. Not just fear of being exposed in the age of social media, but a rather xenophobic and primitive fear of the unknown. Who are these extraterrestrials? Why are they here? How dare they enter our airspace without our permission? Humanity has a long tradition of fearing and hating that which is different, unknown, from elsewhere. Witness the still rampant racial, ethnic, religious, and nationalistic prejudice and hatred that ravage the world of humanity. There is an almost ingrained xenophobic response to the unknown and that which is different. And it is certain that the ETs are more different from us than, say, Protestants are from Catholics in Ireland. I once asked a physicist involved with military and intelligence operations related to UFOs why we were attempting to destroy these spacecraft with advanced space-based weapons. He became agitated and said, "Those cowboys running this thing are so arrogant, so out of control, that they view any entry by a UFO into our rare space as an offense worthy of a hostile response. And they are going to get us into an interplanetary conflict if we are not careful." And so it goes. Fear of the unknown. Greed and control. Institutional inertia. These are a few of what I see as the current animating forces driving the continued secrecy. But where do we go from here? How can we transform this situation from extreme secrecy to disclosure? There is an old Chinese proverb that says, unless we change directions, we are likely to end up where we are going. How true. And where we are going in this area, is immensely dangerous. Extreme secrecy, especially on something this far-reaching and important, undermines democracy, subverts the constitution, concentrates enormous technological power in the hands of the unelected few and puts the entire planet in harm's way. The secrecy must end. The masses must demand full disclosure. U.S. government agencies with current or past involvement. Activities are compartmentalized into super-secret unacknowledged special access projects, which means that they are not acknowledged to anyone, even those senior in the chain of command. NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, NSA, National Security Agency, CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, Military Intelligence Divisions, Army, Air Force, Navy, FOC, Air Force Office of Special Investigations, DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation, Space Commands and others. Private corporate entities believed to be involved. Northrop Grumman, Boeing Aircraft Company, Lockheed Martin, various facilities including Denver Research Center, BDM, formerly Braddock, Dunn and McDonald, E-Systems, Incorporated, Egg and G, Incorporated, Edgerton, Germsaw, Orson and Grier, Incorporated, Wackenhut Corporation, Village Supercomputing, Phoenix as Phillips Laboratory, McDonnell Douglas TRW, Incorporated, Rockwell International, Booz Allen and Hamilton, Incorporated, MITRE Corporation, SAIC, Science Applications International, Incorporated, Bechtel Corporation and others. Testimonial. John Maynard was a military intelligence analyst for the Defense Intelligence Agency. While at the DIA, he became familiar with the compartmentalization process of maintaining secrecy. The NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, is basically run by the Air Force. The Reconnaissance Office, from my understanding from people that I've had contacts with since I retired, has taken on a lot more responsibility, particularly toward the UFO and extraterrestrial activities. You could say that they picked up where Blue Book dropped off. Blue Book was basically an Air Force project for themselves, but those activities finally fell under the purview of the National Reconnaissance Office. Now it is basically a joint service, but it is run by the Air Force and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They have a very ominous job. Not too much is ever really known about exactly what they do, but they're running the successor to the SR-71, which is supposed to be a Delta-type aircraft capable of flying from Los Angeles to London in about 18 minutes. So it goes near space. It's pretty quick. Satellite imagery has pretty much gone to the background. You've still got Talent Keyhole. You've still got Omni. They've got a couple of others up there now that I don't even know the code names for anymore, but most of the reconnaissance is done by aircraft. As far as anti-gravity, they've been working on it for a long, long time. I know that. But basically what I've seen is the magnetic pulse engine. It is a very unique signature when it flies. It has normal type fuel, but it also has a magnetic pulse set up to it. The signature is like a soap on a rope type of contrail behind it. A government is widespread, as everybody knows. It's into everybody's pockets and everybody's life all over the place. The same thing holds true for the UFO/extraterrestrial subject, but few people really have the full knowledge of what's going on. It's held very tightly within black covert operations. If you want to take a good close look at some of the background on it, you can go to civilian organizations outside of NSA, which are direct contractors for NSA. Like Dridon Industries. Why are they flying the SR-71 on reconnaissance using Navy pilots? What are they looking at? What is NSA looking at, when you think about that? Why are they doing these particular things? They are not using it for training, that's for one thing. Within the organization at the executive level, I would dare say that the National Security Advisor, when he comes on board, is fairly well treated as in the know from the top at NSA. His knowledge is still limited, because he's only an appointee, and at that particular point, a new appointee at the CIA is the same way. They will have knowledge, but very limited knowledge. Only some people within the black covert areas will have very specific information about what's going on. But, not very much is known all about the NRO. It's one of those organizations that's so low profile, anytime the question comes up, it's strictly an entity that does reconnaissance in the Air Force, period. It leaves a lot of questions. But as far as UFO and intelligence and extraterrestrial matters go, it's right at the top. And I would say that the president has limited knowledge of it. I know Carter did not have any knowledge whatsoever. And I worked right there with the organization, President Carter's organization. They kept it pretty secret. I think that they made a mistake at Roswell. Rather than admitting it, they covered it, and they covered it because UFO and extraterrestrial activity has been going on a lot longer than this government will admit. I thought it was comical the way Bush.George W. threw the ball into Cheney's court saying that, of anybody who would probably know more about this than anybody else, it would be Cheney. He has some very interesting knowledge of the corporations involved in this matter. Atlantic Research Corporation is one of the big ones. It's not very often heard about. It's an insider beltway bandit, if you want to call it that. Very low profile. Mostly has all of its work done within intelligence. TRW, Johnson Controls, Honeywell. All of them at some point or another became involved with the intelligence field. Certain activities were contracted out to them. Atlantic Research was one of them. Way back. These are entities that were created out of people in the Pentagon to receive projects, grants, and monies to do certain projects that were so highly classified and compartmentalized that you know only about 4 people would know what was going on. So it was that tightly controlled. You would have to look at corporations that were started by people who were retired from the military. Admiral Bobby Inman and his little oversight group out there in California, parenthesis, SAIC, for example. So we would ask the question, who really is controlling JPL? Why was JPL started? Others, Ames Laboratories, Fort Detrick. Some very interesting things come out of Fort Detrick. And Harry Diamond Laboratories, been around for a long, long time. Don't hear much about them, because they're all basically military contracted, and they are in a particular specialty. I don't know if you've ever seen any back engineering notes. How they do it and stuff like that. Very unique. You can get an engineer to tell you how they do it, and the specific notes that you do. You take it forward from somebody's notes, and you can build the item just from the back engineering notes. Got to take it apart to find out how it works. I can think of some stuff that we've gotten out of Roswell. There was also a crash up in Canada in the mid-1950s that was kept very, very hush-hush. There were definitely some engineering projects dealing with those things. Weapons in space is still a big enigma. Black Covert operations have always been trying to do something like that. Star Wars was a big boondoggle. Most of it didn't exist. It was just all on paper. Laser weapons, well, that's a whole different story. There are brand new leaps and bounds that have been made in the laser field. Not only cutting, but pulsed lasers that basically destroy anything they hit. I'm sure we have weapons in space. There is no doubt in my mind about it. They were trying to develop them long before Star Wars became an entity, back in the late 1960s, early 1970s. Nixon wanted something along that line to produce weapons for space. The project started in his administration. People wanted it done. Britain and the United States and Canada were the biggest party to these secrets. They got the Australians involved with it later on. It goes right back to the same thing with these Beltway bandits. Can you get them to say something? No. That's where their bread is buttered. They're not going to step on their own toes, punch themselves in the face. The truth is they have hidden things like UFOs and extraterrestrial information from us for years. Not just the current era, but back before the 1900s. So it's there. It's about time for them to just come forward and say, hey, this is it. Dot. Testimonial. W.H. served as a tech sergeant in the U.S. Air Force from 1963 through 1977. On June 19, 1963, he flew into Wiesbaden Air Force Base in Wiesbaden, Germany with President John F. Kennedy. In the summer of 1966, I was stationed in Colorado Springs when I was called back to Washington, D.C. to pick up an entourage of high-ranking military Air Force officials and scientists. From the we flew from Andrews Air Force Base in Washington, D.C. over to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. We were taken to what is called the Blue Hangar. And in there, they had the remains of the different UFOs that they were experimenting with. This is where Bell Labs was involved, this is where General Electric was involved, this was where a number of high-tech companies gained their knowledge. For instance, the electromagnetic propulsion system. Do you know where the first electromagnetic propulsion system was utilized? Disneyland's monorail. Inside the Blue Hangar, I saw a saucer-shaped craft. I'd guesstimate it to be 30 to 35 feet in diameter, and probably 12 to 14 feet in height. It was extraterrestrial, from one of the crash sites down in New Mexico. One of the briefing officers informed us that there had been over 100 crashes in the New Mexico, Four Corners area. He said the reason was that a large radar dome was in the Four Corners area and that any time that radar system was on and these craft flew through it, they lost control of everything, and the craft would end up crashing. There was an opening in the ET craft where it would basically drop down into the entrance. There were no windows. It appeared to be seamless and it was aluminium in color. From there, we went to Los Angeles, then left the next morning and flew to Hickam Air Force Base in Hawaii. Later on we discovered we had actually landed in Kauai, and that we were on a top secret, high security Navy base known as Barking Sands. We were taken out to an observation post looking to the west. The sun had come up behind us and about this time somebody yelled out, "Craft!" The craft had come out of the water from our left to our right, and it came out and centered maybe 200 yards and about 100 yards off the water. This craft was again saucer-shaped, but at the mid-beam it had an oscillating light that was going back and forth on it. I didn't see portholes, I didn't see windows or anything like that. It disappeared as quickly as it appeared. And we're all talking about it and everything, and about that time they yelled out, "It's back." This time it was closer in, about 100 yards out and 200 feet off the water. It sits there and basically rocks back and forth, goes up, goes down, goes out and comes back. And then it turned at an angle and went back into the water. Now what's amazing about this is that when it came out of the water and re-entered the water, there was no explosion or implosion as it went into the water. When I asked, "How was that?" I was told, when you have electromagnetic propulsion, it's basically in a shell. So as it's entering, this force goes in ahead and the craft follows it in. Same thing coming out. That was in the fall of 1966. I think the purpose was more of an introduction to the craft, the fact that it was coming out of the water. So therefore, it could operate underwater. To this day, I do not know why the crew was taken to see it. I was brought in as Special Air Missions Flight Steward and Low Ad Master. And the reason for that was I had had previous presidential clearance. So I had a high classified clearance. That's the only reason I think I was there. In the summer of 1966, we were flying with a contingency of high-ranking naval officers and civilian engineers and scientists. This was called Project Mercury. We flew into White Sands, got off the aircraft, and were put on a bus. All the windows were blacked out. We basically had to show our identification. They had a checklist. All the names were checked off. And we were then driven for about 45 minutes to an hour, into a box canyon. When we got to that canyon, another security group came on and rechecked all of the IDs. When we got in there was a craft, very similar to the one that was at the Blue Hangar in Ohio. Similar in shape, dry landing gear, door down. And there were two living ETs there. They were less than 5 feet tall. They were what we call the graylings. We were about 100 yards away from them. Fortunately, the bus driver had a set of binoculars, so I was locked in and looking at what I could see. They had the large eyes, slim mouth, long slim arms and hands, slim body, and they were wearing an aluminium-colored one-piece flight suit. The entourage was around them and then, basically, they looked in the craft. The meeting with the two ETs and the tour of the craft lasted about 2 hours. When everyone returned to the bus, nothing was said about it. The communication, as far as I understand, was all telepathic. Project Mercury was at White Sands. Project X was in Hawaii at Kauai. Someone was discussing it while we were on the plane. Nothing was ever in writing, nothing on the manifest, nothing on the mission sheet mentioned those names. I had a dear friend, Wellesley Bond, he was in the CIA. And he was the one who basically briefed incoming presidents in regard to UFO and ET phenomena. President Reagan, for one, was thoroughly briefed. And he said, there are 37 ET species that are known at this time, might have been as many as 39. He told me of the case of President Carter where he had gone down to Fort Huachuca down by Sierra Vista, Arizona. Where he had actually seen the body of the ET. And he had tears in his eyes, and he says, "Oh, my God. They're alive." In February of 2014, Wellesley called me and said, "I'm ready to release all this information." And he had shared a lot with me. He had extensive computers. He had two laptops, He had two state-of-the-art PCs, he had made numerous DVDs that he had put all this information on. I would say in excess of 100 DVDs. He was staying in a real low-end motel down in Phoenix, Arizona. And when I got there, which was the very next day, he was gone. None of that stuff was there. Not one item. And I know that he kept stuff in a storage unit somewhere, and if that storage unit. I don't know whether they made him disclose where that storage unit was. But knowing him, he would have never told them. So somebody murdered him and has all that information. In regard to the secrecy behind the use apps and why there has not been disclosure regarding the UFO and ET phenomena and the facts that do exist, I personally believe that number one, it has to do with industrial greed. Many companies have made exceptional profits off of the technology, both in the communications world. Bell Laboratories, and General Electric in regard to propulsion systems. And other major Fortune 100 companies that have shared. That's what I personally feel. The other thing is, I think that the world has been ready. People truly believe that the UFO and ET phenomena does exist. The world is ready to hear this and we're tired of the games. Testimonial. William John Paul Eck was a computer operations and programming specialist in the Air Force in the mid-1960s, first at Pope Air Force Base and then in Vietnam. At his request, his testimony was only to be made public after his death. The first, UFO, event of my lifetime awoke me to a new paradigm. Late one night, a young lady and I were in the woods about 30 miles southeast of Fayetteville, North Carolina when a UFO announced its presence from about a 300-foot distance by prompting all the frogs, crickets and noisemakers to shut off like a light switch. It appeared 20 or 30 seconds later and passed by us at about 200 or 300 feet, on a line only 40 to 50 feet away from us, heading from the southeast to the northwest at about 11:25 at night. After it disappeared over a small lake, there continued a period of silence for another 20 or 30 seconds, then the frogs, crickets and all the other noisemakers turned on again, as if someone had thrown a light switch. That event was rather dramatic in my mind in that it prompted me to start questioning what was really going on in the world. After I left the military, I was asked to help Rusco Electronics. At the time they were the largest manufacturer and installer of access control equipment in the world. Within a year or two I went from doing corporate level work in the Denver area. Which, at the time was growing like a mushroom. To doing military work, national work, and getting my security clearance back and activated again. This led to doing a lot of work for the State Department. During this period of time, I was developing security systems out of a national security interest, in addition to large corporate systems. In 1979, I came across a company in North Glen, Colorado that was developing implantable chips, originally for horses, because there was a major problem then of the shilling of horses. You would have two horses that look alike, and you would put the dog in and bet against him when everybody thinks it's this fast one, or you'd reverse that and bet against him. That pill dot, if you want to call it that, was already small enough by then to implant under the horse's skin with a hypodermic needle. I was shown these, and they worked. We could read them with a hand wand type reader from about 7 or 8 feet away. This was still primitive technology, but at that time in the security industry, a lot of us had concerns about tracking and locating people who had been kidnapped. Particularly what was going on in Europe at the time, where we were having naval officers, even the Prime Minister of Italy, kidnapped. These people were drained of sensitive information, brutalized, or both. One of the goals of the industry was to develop technology that would allow us to track these people or locate them quickly. I brought this technology to a meeting in a SIF, a Secure Communication Intelligence, Information Facility, room in Virginia. It was arranged by a friend of mine with the CIA, and Bob, another friend of mine with the State Department, to introduce this technology to, what we thought at the time, were the right parties to use this new technology responsibly. We met in this room, and because of the tight meetings we were involved with, certain people would not give you their full name or where they came from. I just had to trust that my two contacts had contacted the right parties to be there at the right time and that they would all be responsible individuals. It was a mistake. After that meeting, I discovered that two of the people in the meeting had never been asked there. Yet they knew about the meeting, they knew what it was about, they knew who was going to be there.